You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
From the author of the book by the same name, it's the Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast with Mark McCray. Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of the Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast. I'm Dan Klink, of course, joined by the great, the beautiful, the wonderful Mark McCray.
Hey, everybody. How's everybody doing tonight?
Everyone's doing great. They're all, at any point in their place in the space-time continuum listening to this, they're all shouting into their headset. We're doing great, Mark. We're doing great. Thanks for asking. We're also joined by your friendly neighborhood, JT Wheatley, Master and Commander of the History of Comic Books podcast, also over on Thunder Talk with us. Had to bring in some backup on this one. How you doing, Wheatley?
Doing good. Feeling a little outclassed right now, though.
Oh, well, hey, you're going to fake it till you make it. That's what I do. Or, you know, maybe hit the sauce a little bit. Maybe get into your cups for the show.
I'm down to Heineken and some Canadian whiskey already, so.
Hey, you know what's going on then. Yeah. I mean, unless you're paying a copay, let's keep the internal stuff internal. I'm kidding. I love you. Tonight, we have editor, producer over at Adult Swim, Ned Hastings.
Hello.
Hey, Ned.
Glad to be here.
How you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm doing good.
Excellent. Excellent. We are so glad to have you.
I'm excited.
Well, you know, everybody should be excited because Mark, as Mark does, conjured up something out of left field that really should be center stage. I'm mixing my sports and theater, whatever. Superman. Superman had several iterations in the comic books, on television. Well, you know what, Mark? You can say this much better than I can. Well, I want you to let everybody know what's up.
Okay, yeah. So the New Adventures of Superman that premiered in 1966 was this huge game changer. The series produced huge ratings, bigger ratings than anyone had ever seen before. And because of that, it got the attention of the sponsors. Fred Silverman, who greenlit the show, got his first big promotion, and it established Filmation as a serious player in the kid space. One of the things that's really interesting about the Superman series is that it seems as though every season there was some type of character design change. During the third and final season of the series, Filmation Studios was bragging about the fact that their animated version of Superman was based on Kurt Swan, Superman, from the comic books. Kurt Swan was, at the time, you know, I guess the embodiment of the greatest Superman artist of all time. And looking at the cartoon, I'm not exactly sure if it was necessarily based on Kurt Swan, but I have theories about other things. And so it'll be great tonight that we can debate some of these topics regarding the Superman animated series from 66 to 68 and what the character design possibly was based on.
We're going deep. We're going deep with it. We're going to let that digest for a moment. Ned, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do at Adult Swim?
Okay. Well, I first and foremost am an editor. We have a sort of a strange production technique there where we create, we get the audio first and the script, and we create a radio play first. And then over that, we start putting picture, which is basically Photoshops and freeze frames, and create kind of a moving storyboard, an animated storyboard, an animatic.
Right.
And then we make all of our changes and our rewrites and our re-edits and things like that in that realm in Final Cut Pro, or now Premiere Pro. And then we hand it off to the animators. So the reason I'm also a producer is because, generally speaking, I'm working by myself. I'm making decisions in terms of two shots, one shot, three shot, wide shot, narrow, you know, when do we cut, you know, when do we reveal certain things? And I'm also building the radio play. So that's what I do. And I originally worked for Space Ghosts, and then I worked for Aqua Teen Hunger Force for the run of that show. And I worked on the first season of Squidbillies and then would jump in and out of it occasionally while I was working on Aqua Teen. And then when Aqua Teen was canceled, I moved over to Squidbillies full time.
Nice. All right. Very cool. Very cool.
Oh, yeah.
So with Superman and his animated stylized origins, Who gets the credit? Where does it go? Ned, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I was looking for the Kurt Swan vibe, and I don't really see it. I mean, he is very beefy and muscular the way Swan drew him, and by the 70s, they were drawing, or late 60s, early 70s, they were starting to draw him a lot leaner. You know, that all the superheroes were becoming more modernized, and, you know, Batman also had been very blocky before that, and depending on the artist, you know, by 68 or 69, you had Neil Adams, who was drawing that sinewy, beautiful Batman. And Superman, similarly, I'm not sure who was taking over his, maybe Dick Giordano by that time. Remember. But anyway, so the animated Superman is definitely beefy the way that Kurt Swan Superman is. But Kurt Swan, to me, that was a very blocky style. Everybody was very wide across the hips, and so I don't see the Kurt Swan with that cartoon.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if anything, so just to give everybody a little background, when I worked at Adult Swim, Ned and I would just pass each other by and have these great conversations. And somehow we got on the topic of Kurt Swan and also Kurt Schaffenberger.
Yeah.
And one versus the other. To me, I always thought that third season of Superman looked more like a Schaffenberger design because it was a little more cartoony. You know, he worked on the Lois Lane books and he based his design of Lois Lane on his wife. And as far as dressing Lois and Lana, he relied on his wife and daughter and fashion magazines to dress them appropriately. And, you know, Archie Comics, Dan DiCarlo did the same thing, which is interesting because, in my opinion, I felt at times there was no difference between a Lois Lane book and a Betty and Veronica book.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just like Lana and Lois were fighting over Superman and Betty and Veronica were fighting over Archie and everyone was dressed to the nines.
Right.
So here's something interesting I uncovered a while ago. So when Superman became this huge hit in 1966, Fred Silverman ordered Filmation to continue making cartoons because it was a foregone conclusion that there was definitely going to be a second season. And so a lot of the season two episodes were made in 1966 by that original crew. And the network just banked those episodes until the second season.
That makes sense.
Right. And second season, the show became the Superman Aquaman Hour of Adventure. And when you watch those Aquaman cartoons and Justice League and Teen Titans cartoons, it almost looks like a completely different animation company was working on these. Superman technically only shows up in three Justice League of America cartoons. And that crew from 67 worked on those three cartoons. And that face and body of Superman in that second season, in my opinion, is sort of like the closest thing to Kurt Swan. More in his face, not so much the body, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ned, Dan and I, we went out to PowerCon and we interviewed these veteran Filmation.
These titans of animation industry.
Right.
They were old Filmation guys?
So it was like Michael Swanigan, who wrote the first Filmation book, and Rob Lamb and Tom T and Larry Houston. And according to Michael Swanigan, it was definitely based on Kurt Swan. And I said, what about season two and one? And he told me it was definitely season three. Also, back in those days, too, I feel like a lot of the animation directors and animators, they took certain liberties. So maybe the animator that worked on season two Superman Justice League, maybe he was a fan of comic books and decided, you know what? I'm going to make our Superman look as close to Swan or Schaffenberger as possible. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But yeah. So, I mean, it's just a theory. Like I said, it's just a theory, but I still appreciate the fact that they were going to the comic books to guide them in terms of character design.
Yeah.
Because by the time you get to the Super Friends, you have a veteran like Alex Toth working on the Super Friends, who's a comic book guy, cartoon guy through and through.
And already had history with Hanna-Barbera.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And he had a different take, I feel like, on the DC designs.
Well, you know, we brought in our resident expert, J.T. Wheatley. What are your thoughts? What are your hopes? What are your dreams? What do you want to say about all this?
Well, being explained like that, because I get with the ways that the first two seasons were practically filmed back-to-back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. They would stick the original Kurt Swan design, because Kurt Swan is still considered, like, he did the definitive Superman to this day.
Right.
But, yeah, with the third season, I guess there was a gap in between the second and third season.
Yeah.
They decided to just finally do a redesign.
Yes.
Schaffenberger, you look at the Swan, he's the more blockier, stronger, more authoritative-looking Superman. He almost has, a slightly receding hairline, too, mm-hmm. if you look at his face.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I mean, don't we all, right?
Yeah, makes him more, makes him more look a little older, whereas Schaffenberger, a little leaner, fuller head of hair, because he wrote the more romantic angle to Superman, because it's Superman and Lois Lane, more open up and friendly.
Right.
So, yeah, I can definitely see that in the third season when they brought him around, like, yeah, let's make him look a little more friendlier, leaner, a little leaner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe back in their head they were thinking, well, this is probably more appealing to the our female viewers if we can get them.
Do you like podcasts?
Then you're going to hate Thunder Talk.
Tasteless subject matter.
Mature humor.
Contempt for our co-hosts.
Unapologetic social views.
Edgy music.
And total irreverence for the nerd junk we love.
Are all reasons why
no one.
No one.
No one should listen to Thunder Talk.
Find us on the ESO Network.
And all podcasting platforms.
Or don't.
Whatever.
One thing I do notice about the cartoon, Superman's cape is short, which that to me is very Kurt Swan.
Oh my gosh.
The cape comes just mid-thigh on the back, and it's like later it would get fairly long. It changes, but it's short. And that always bugged me about Kurt Swan. It looked out of balance with that big blocky body.
Yeah. You know what, Ned? I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's the other thing that I feel separates season one and two versus season three. Like, the cape was definitely shorter. And because the budget was like one of the lowest budgets from season one. Season two, they didn't have a problem because the show became a hit. But season one, the budget was lower than the Hanna-Barbera and a lot of the other studios. But they sort of compensated by making that cape the star of the cartoon, because they made sure that cape moved around a lot. And
yeah, it does, actually, now that you mention that.
And I think it was just an easy thing for an animator to do to give the illusion of more action, even though it's just Superman flying kind of stiff. But if the cape is blowing in the wind, or when he lands, the cape, you know, follows him down. That's one of the things that I've noticed, that they seem to use a cape. The cape has a lot of action to make up for lack of budget or what Superman can actually do. And in season three,
it's really interesting.
Season three, since it was a new crew, not so much. Superman's cape seems to be kind of stiff, but Superman is sort of moving a little bit more than season one Superman action wise. So I guess they didn't necessarily need the cape as much. I don't know. I mean,
Kate's kind of a cheat. Maybe they felt like they didn't need to cheat.
Right. Yeah. You know. Right. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. But it's still interesting what these guys had to do in order to make a cartoon interesting and get kids to watch. Although, you know, it is Superman who, you know, I remember I wasn't even reading comic books and I knew who Superman was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And when I started reading comic books, that's when I found out about some of the other superheroes. But initially, I knew who Superman was. And I have three older brothers, and none of them were buying comic books. So I don't know if it was in my consciousness somehow, or in the consciousness of the world, but I knew who Superman was from the very beginning.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah, they say that's when a pop culture hype becomes a truly pop culture icon, is when you know everything about the character, having never read his original work.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's been part of our cultural DNA for 70 years. Easy.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody said he may have been the first character with an action figure, because there was actually a wooden Superman doll that came out in like the 40s.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, they think that's like the first action figure.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Dang.
It's basically a puppet without strings, but yeah. And it's painted and
yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, hey, all you collectors out there, go ahead and hit us up.
I've seen those things, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now, Mark, Did you see this cartoon when it first came out? I don't know how old you would have been.
Oh, Mark. I would have been like...
2 or 3, right?
About
a gentleman never asks and a lady never tells.
I would say at least 4 years old. I will say that. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Because
I looked it up and and this cartoon debuted 1 week after I was born.
Wow. Oh, that's pretty cool.
And 2 days after the debut of Star Trek.
Interesting. Oh. Hey, 1966 was a great year because...
Big year. Batman, Star Trek.
There
is... West Batman,
A separate website, I can't remember the name of it, and they sort of list like all the iconic series and or events that happened, you know, movies and TV shows that happened in 1966. And
there was a great blog site. It was called My Favorite Year.
Yeah.
And it was about 1966. And I used to check in on it like every day. And he went for years doing it. And then like after 2016, I think he was like, okay, I'm done. I've done every minute, every month of 66. Yeah. He would do like a whole block of just the comic books that came out that one on a particular week that year, you know, of 1966. That was always fun because it would be a weird mix of like the Marvel stuff and the DC stuff and then the Charlton and the Gold Key and Archie and all that stuff. It was really a fun blog. It's still up. You can go back and dig through it.
Yeah.
If that's the one you're talking about, mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
I'm not 100% sure if that was the one, but I just know that I read some stuff about 1966 being this really great year for great series and movies and all of that kind of fun stuff.
It was a big year.
Yeah.
It was a big year.
So,
sounds like it.
I wanted to move on a little bit and talk about Superboy as well. And I can't really talk to this. And, you know, Wheatley and Ned, maybe you know a little bit more about this. And so... The reason they're not releasing anything Superboy related is because the Siegel family, they own the Superboy character. Is that it?
Yeah, they own the copyright specifically on Superboy. It's a weird thing with the copyright laws.
Oh, like to this day?
To this day, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Is it because after they sold Superman for relatively cheap, then they thought, well, we're going to hang on to this one? Because it was like 20 years later before Superboy came around, right?
Yeah,
right. Like, was the 50s?
Yeah, I want to say when Jerry Siegel actually brought back, after he originally sued him, the right to series.
Right.
They introduced Superboy, which is really just Adventures of Superman as a kid in Smallville. But because that was part of the original contract, like I think the courts ruled you own Superboy specifically, but not everything else around it. So it's like it's
interesting.
It's like this weird thing, like it's only valuable to DC. So you can always sell it to them.
Is it Siegel and Schuster or just Siegel?
I think it's a Siegel, because I think Schuster was out of the picture at that point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we all know those two went through in terms of getting... In terms of what Superman became as an IP, it was finally the Superman film, 78, Richard Donner, where Warner Brothers decided to give the two like a yearly stipend of $20,000 each.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Just to be like, hey, we love you. Thank you.
And a credit.
And
too.
A credit. Exactly.
The created by credit has to be on there. And then they did the same with Bob Kane. And yeah.
Right.
And now Bob Kane and Bill Finger, they do.
Well, Bob Kane always had the contract where he was credited alone by DC, but he cut Bill Finger out, which is,
Yeah, that's pretty ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, people get on to Stan Lee about supposedly cutting out his co-creators, but what Bob Kane did, he did it on paper. So.
Wow.
It always fascinates Mark and I how mature for children's content is behind the scenes, how rated R all of this G-rated G material is when you go behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Ruthless.
These are grown-ups making this stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's funny talking about Kurt Schaffenberger. I always associate him with Superboy.
Yes.
To me, like even in the 70s, he was still doing the Superboy stories. And it always had a real Archie Comics look to me, which I wasn't fond of.
Well, a lot of that was because Schaffenberger originally came through Fawcett Comics, where he worked on originally Captain Marvel and the Marvel family.
Yeah.
And of course, the irony is once DC sued them into oblivion, they couldn't use Captain Marvel. They bring all those artists over and they proceed to Marvelize, for want of a better term, Superman. Like, Otto Binder co-created the original Supergirl as a tribute to Mary Marvel. And
right.
Yeah. So Schaffenberger, so that it will be natural because he also worked on the Captain Marvel Jr., which is more or less Superboy. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a great image online where it's Captain Marvel Jr. and Superboy just like either they're meeting each other or they're just standing side to side. And it's a, you know, Schaffenberger picture and it looks really good. And I always liked Schaffenberger as an artist. I mean, I just thought that the artwork had like really clean lines and,
oh, yes.
And there was a certain, I don't know, a certain glamour to how he drew the DC mm-hmm. characters. And recently someone found this online and I might have lost the photo on my old phone because I switched phones recently. But it was like a side job that Schaffenberger had done for Archie Comics. And it was just kind of interesting to see his take on Archie Comics because the Lois Lane books always reminded me of the Betty and mm-hmm. Veronica books.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I wanted him to necessarily draw on Archie Comics, as it was kind of, I don't know, it was just a little weird and strange, you know what I mean? And, you know, interesting.
That's interesting. I guess one thing that was neat about his art for Superboy was, you know, in the 70s, those stories were taking place in the late 50s, early 60s. And so his look was clean and it was uncluttered and it was not super modern. So maybe it did have a sort of a neat retro appeal, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Schaffenberger drew a lot of Supergirl too.
Yes.
Yes.
And until like DC decided they're going to take Supergirl in a different direction, they brought in Mike Sikosky to start drawing Supergirl and they gave her the new costume. Well, actually, she had a new costume every issue, it seemed.
Yeah.
And after he took over, I sort of preferred his look because it was just a little more grown up. And, you know, he drew a lot of the early Justice League stories, too. But there is a Brave and Bold comic book. It's the first pairing of Wonder Woman and Supergirl. And nothing really happens. I'm like, well, you have the two most powerful women in the DC universe. And the story is just fluff. Then they paired them up again. Wheatley, you might have to help me out on this. There was an artist that used to draw Supergirl a lot also. And so in this pairing, Supergirl and Wonder Woman are fighting over a villain.
Ooh.
When I
fighting over a man.
Right. And when I finally found the book on eBay and I opened it up, I was just disappointed. First of all, again, more fluff, and I was just disappointed by the art.
Yeah.
And I just cannot remember who the artist is, but it's someone, it wasn't a Wonder Woman artist, even though it was a Wonder Woman book, but it was an artist that was really closely associated with Supergirl. But artwork to me was sort of like borderline, almost like, like a children's book.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and I'm just like, wow, this is the artist you choose for the two strongest women in the DC universe?
Funny.
I just didn't understand the decision. But then there's cool moments later in her history where Don Heck,
that's who I remember,
who was primarily
a
Marvel artist, he drew a couple of issues of Wonder Woman and it was great.
I remember Heck drawing some Supergirl too in like mm-hmm. maybe Superman Family or.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Yeah, like, so Don Heck, you know, he primarily worked with Marvel, but I think every now and then, you know, DC would throw him a bone and, hey, you want to do some freelance work with us? And
he did the last few issues of the original Teen Titans run. I remember that was kind of my introduction to him.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I didn't care for, I don't know who his finisher was, but I didn't really care for his look. It was everybody was very angular and had very sharp cheekbones and I just didn't think I didn't think they looked good.
that is so true. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Did you ever wonder why there are 24-hour kid networks? In my book, The Best Saturdays of Our Lives, I write about how Saturday morning became a competitive business and the proving ground for what would become the 24-hour kid network. My book covers the big bang of the 1960s explosion of high ratings to the early digital age of Saturday morning's last hurrah, the 1990s. You can purchase my book by going to thebestsaturdaysofourlives.com and I will ship you a signed copy. So one of the other topics I wanted to talk about was Supergirl, because I just find it kind of interesting. Not that I was waiting with bated breath as a kid about Supergirl becoming an animated character, but Filmation Productions did the DC characters, then Hanna-Barbera did a production with Super Friends for a long time, long association. Ruby Spears did an awesome Superman show from the 1980s.
She never showed up in that one either?
Nope.
No, Wonder Woman did.
Wonder Woman did, and that was a really cool episode, actually. But we had to wait until Superman, the animated series, for Supergirl to show up. And Bruce Timm, they gave her a new costume and everything.
It's a new identity. She's not. She's actually not Kryptonian.
Oh, really? Yeah, why did it take all the way until Bruce Timm, until we got Supergirl, and she wasn't Kryptonian, question mark?
Didn't my memory of that character is that he flies back to where Krypton was and meets her, and she's from another planet from the same solar system, so the red sun, yellow sun thing has an effect on her. That's my memory. It's been a long time. But,
okay.
So she's not his cousin either.
Oh, is she supposed to like the same planet that Mon-El was from?
Maybe.
Like he's kind of the Superman.
I don't think they said it by name.
Okay.
There was a time where I could name his planet.
Oh, yeah.
Daxam?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Good God, that's wrong. I shouldn't know that. I was a big Legion fan.
But getting back to Supergirl animation and even live action, I mean, let's even talk about all the Superman series. You know, there's been a ton of Superman shows, Lois and Clark or whatever, and no love for Supergirl. And I'm just like, why? Like, do people just forget about her? Were the licensing rights higher for Supergirl for live action and animation? It's just sort of a weird thing that a person who's so closely associated with Superman didn't get a play.
Well, you hate to address the elephant in the room, but just flat-out sexism is all I could think of. It's like, oh, a female can't lead a superhero cartoon.
So. I would argue that DC criminally ignored that character for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
I mean, I was thinking about that, and really the Barbara Gordon Batgirl to a certain extent too. They didn't really have a lot of presence in the DC universe outside of just a token backup story here and there. Supergirl,
right.
By the time I was really reading the comics, she just had her little 8 pages in Superman Family. And same with Batgirl and Batman Family. And then when they made Detective a dollar comic. And other than that, you know, they just didn't exist.
Yeah. And it probably didn't help that they were not part of the Justice League.
Right.
At all.
Right.
You know, like, so Supergirl is one of those characters. She was really too old to be a Teen Titan.
Right.
And too junior to be part of the Justice League.
In a lot of ways, she was kind of too powerful to be a Teen Titan, too.
Right.
I think.
Right.
Now they,
I mean, she has the powers of Superman, just not as popular.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
So that could have been it, too. It's like, well, we have Superman.
You know what's interesting, though? I just realized, even though Supergirl wasn't doing much in the DCU, by the mid-70s, they were starting to roll with Justice League stories on Earth 2 in Adventure Comics, and Power Girl was a pretty big character in that. And she's the same character, just the Earth 2 version, right?
Yes, pretty much.
Right. Right.
I mean, she's the Earth 2 Kara Zor-El.
Right.
God, I can't believe I know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 points to Ned, everybody. 10 points to Ned.
And she had a very different personality than Supergirl. So, you know, once you had the Justice League from Earth 1 would get together with the Justice Society from Earth 2.
Always fun.
Oh, yeah.
And one year, Power Girl came over to Earth 1 and she meets the younger Superman from Earth 1. And she goes, well, Superman, take me on a tour of the satellite. And someone on the Justice Society side says, well, you know, I mean, isn't Superman technically your cousin? And she goes, no, the other Superman on Earth 2 is my cousin. I'm not related to this guy. And she just grabs Superman's arm and they just start walking down the hallway for the tour.
So that's three chicks going after Superman.
Hey, every little boy's dream.
Don't get me started on the mermaid.
Throw a little like sideways cousin action in there.
Oh, I love this. Is in the Batman Superman comic of not that long ago, but there was a scene where the Superboy and the Connor Kent of this universe. He gets trapped with. Turns out it's the Supergirl from the future, who's Lois Lane and Superman's daughter. he gets trapped in there, and they're technically related because, of course, Connor Kent is a clone to Superman in a weird way.
Right.
But he gets trapped in like, this weird trap that's like shrinking and forcing him together. And he says out loud, I had to be trapped with you instead of Power Girl. And she goes, I heard that.
Like, what?
Because Power Girl had certain assets that made her appealing.
Yes, and yet also related to him. Genetically speaking.
Well, not in the same dimension, though. Is it?
Wow.
Oh, DC continuity.
Actually, I was going to say, wasn't Supergirl, I don't know how long that lasted, but didn't they have Supergirl stories with the Legion at some point?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, where she went to the future.
Yeah.
And
Right. After Superboy stopped, then they kind of, because remember there's a thing with Brainiac 5. There was
she had a romance with Brainiac 5, and at sometimes they were together in the future. But with Superboy, I think Saturn Girl created a post-hypnotic suggestion.
He found out something he wasn't supposed to know in terms of history, and they had to wipe his mind.
And
I think something similar kind of happened with Supergirl.
Right.
She had to stop going.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. So there is a really great Kurt Swan. I think it's the last Kurt Swan book that he did, because DC was getting ready to prepare for Crisis. You know, it's almost like they were closing out the whole Earth One continuity.
Whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow?
Yes. That story. Yeah. Thank you.
That's a crazy story. I actually have the original of that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I bought it on the stand.
There's a sad part in that story where Supergirl returns to the past with the Legion of Superheroes, and Superman knows that she's going to die.
In the crisis.
And it's just sort of, it's heartbreaking, you know? I mean, it's like, what do you do? You know, do you tell the person that's going to happen? Or I just, that part really got to me.
That whole story, Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow, is so depressing.
Mm-hmm.
So depressing.
Yeah, it really is. But anyway, hey, I don't want to... I don't bring everyone down, but...
Hey, Mark, actually, you know, you and I went back and forth. I think it's worth talking about getting back to the cartoon, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
That history of the cartoon and the voices and the... I mean, here's a question. Is it called The New Adventures of Superman because the TV show was called The Adventures of Superman? Or is it you know what I'm saying? Are they seeing it as kind of like a animated sequel to the show in a way?
I don't know. I mean, there are no stories that say that they were influenced by the George Reeves version. But, you know, you and I, we went back and forth with our emails the other day talking about stuff. And, you know, it is sort of a combination of the radio show and
the TV show.
New adventures, right, of Superman. Because, you know, Inspector Henderson shows up in animation form. But I have to think that maybe they were secretly, well, not even secretly, you know, based on Filmation's business strategy, the fact that they made an entire programming strategy of continuing live action series, because
that's what they did with Star Trek.
Right. With Star Trek. They also did it with, in some degree, with Batman, the 68 Batman series. I feel like it was heavily based on Adam West's live action Batman series, except it didn't really have the camp element.
Right.
But, you know, the...
On some level, though, you could imagine anybody would capitalize on that show in terms of, you know, the public consciousness of the character and continuing certain things.
Right.
I mean, almost anybody would do that, even if they weren't trying to.
Right, because Ted Knight was imitating the narrator on the Batman animated series from 68.
Well, it was William Dozier, who was the producer of the show. Yeah.
He was imitating that guy.
I hadn't thought about that. But didn't Ted Knight also narrate the Superboy cartoons for Filmation before Batman?
I think that was an actor named... Oh, my gosh.
Well, no, the Beck guy did the Superman cartoons, but I think Ted Knight did the Superboy cartoons.
Oh, yeah. That's probably true. I just can't remember. Yeah, that's probably true.
He's in the credits.
Right.
I just watched a quick YouTube doc on Too Close for Comfort. Let's talk about Jim J. Bullock and his contributions. DC animated. I'm sorry. Keep going. My apologies.
Now, that's one of the Batman cartoon. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Adam West and Burt Ward come back to voice the Batman and Robin with that cartoon as well?
In the filmation.
In the 70s.
Yeah.
Casey Kasem did Robin as well, pretty heavily, if I'm not mistaken.
Casey Kasem and is it Olin Soule? Is that how it's pronounced, Mark?
Yes.
Were the voices of Batman and Robin in the late 60s Filmation cartoon.
Right.
And then Hanna-Barbera basically poached them as the Batman and Robin voices for Super Friends. And then when Filmation relaunched their new Batman cartoon in the 70s, they went back and got Adam West and Burt Ward because Soule and Kasem were on Super Friends. So did I get that right, Mark?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it went 10 down.
Points, Ned. Everybody, he's crushing it, dude.
I really liked that Batman 70s cartoon. I was a big fan of that cartoon.
I like the cartoon. I like the rotoscoping. I like the background music. I mean, it really made Batman look athletic in that series.
Yes.
And it was pretty cool.
And that Filmation, the original one, the 60s one is really one of my earliest TV memories. Like, I think it came out like 68, so I was like 2 years old. And I remember it.
Yeah, the one from 68, I love that one too because, you know, most of the DC guys wrote the stories and the Penguin on that series is hilarious. He is the king of snark. Like, there is a writer named Bill Keenan that wrote a lot of the Penguin stories and scripts.
Oh,
and
funny.
He makes the Penguin really sound like the snarkiest. It is just so funny. It's a good series. Too. And one of the things that Ned and I would talk about with that 68 series, Ned told me that he loved how Batman and Robin would jump in a Batmobile. You know, they would do the run.
They would run and jump. They would like vault over the trunk.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And my brother and I would watch that and just like, oh, that's so cool. So to me, I was like, if I saw Batman and Robin get in the car without doing that, I was like, oh, they just used the door.
Yeah, they got in the car like just like regular schmuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the way they would dive into that Batmobile, it's like, dude, that's exactly how I'm going to get into a car when I'm a grown up. Who's going to stop me?
Oh, my God.
Through the sunroof.
Yeah, right?
There is an episode from that series where the Joker runs for mayor and he has all the voting machines fixed. And he puts Batman and Robin and Commissioner Gordon and the police officer. Police O'Hara. So, see, that's the other connection between the live action.
Yeah, because that is definitely a TV show character. Yeah.
Right.
Hold up. We're not trying to get nailed by that Dominion, like $20 billion lawsuit. Okay. I'm not trying to go down like OEN news here.
Oh, my gosh.
We're not trying to Newsmax this, everybody.
But, the episode is like pretty subversive because the Joker gives a press release. And there is someone, and this was definitely an animator trying to make a joke. One of the reporters is representing the KKK network. That is the mic that's represented in the cartoon.
Oh, my God. This is like they were seeing the future.
Right.
They were
right.
Seeing the future in every way.
Or they were just seeing 1968, which was its own horrible thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you were a monster kid growing up, if you enjoyed Saturday mornings watching Monster Movie Matinee, or staying up all night watching the midnight feature, then Monster Attack is the podcast for you. We not only look at classic old monster movies, we share our experience growing up as a monster kid. Join us every Monday for Monster Attack.
So the Superman cartoon, though, the Filmation Superman cartoon, those voices were ported over.
From the radio show.
Right.
Right. And
so Bud Collier was Superman for like a decade on the radio something like that?
Right. Yeah, that Superman radio show ran a long time. And, you know, he was also the voice in the Fleischer Superman short. And
that's what I love. So he was Superman from like 1940, what, 3 or 4?
When did those come out?
I thought those came out in 41, maybe?
Yeah, around
42. Yeah.
We had a VHS tape of the old Fleischers that I would watch endlessly. It was two of the Fleischer shorts.
They're beautiful.
VHS.
Oh, yeah.
But I also had the 44, the record of those exact same Fleischer shorts plus two additional ones. It was from my goddamn, my dad had it. It was one of those records you inherit from your parents.
Right.
It was an audio dramatization of the Fleischer shorts. And I was familiar with two of them because of the video.
Funny. Yeah. There's like, what, six or eight of those, Summit? Do you know what I mean?
I think there were 16 of them. I think Fleischer did eight of the shorts, and then Famous Studios did the other eight. But, you know, I actually have the DVD. Okay. I can go take a quick look.
I have a couple of copies of it because I bought the DVDs at one point, and then later on I bought the DVD set of the like that big 10, the Superman movies all in a package together, and the cartoons are on that also. It's that silver tin box with the S emblem that has the four Chris Reeve movies, and the, I guess, Superman Returns is in there also, and then the cartoons.
I'm one of four people that liked Superman Returns. I thought it was classy how they bled in the John Williams. I liked how they dug up the Ghost of Marlon Brando, some kind of Hollywood Ouija board magic that they did.
There's a lot of things in that movie that I like. There's a lot of things I like in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't hate that movie.
Ironically, my problem was I think it was too reverential to the Superman 1 and 2. I wish they had tried doing something different.
They just ignored 3 and 4.
But then they did Man of Steel and went too far the other direction. So.
Yeah.
Thinking about it that way, Wheatley, they might have like three fans now. Because now I'm kind of You know what? My son was about to be born. I was about to be a dad for the first time. So I think I was really in my feels. Mm. Like there a lot of people were like, Dan, we want our money back. That sucks. You made us go see this movie. And it was awful.
Yeah, I don't hate it at all. I don't hate it at all.
I mean, who's paying you to hate it, you know?
Right? What's the point?
What's the point?
Okay.
What you got?
So here are the facts with Max Fleischer. There are 17.
Oh, I was still interneting that. Okay, well, you win. Okay, 10 points to Mark.
Yep.
Wheatley, better hope for a daily double here.
Yeah, Mark beat you analog style, so.
Okay, so there's 17 theatrical shorts. They came out in 1941. Famous Studios did eight of the shorts.
Okay.
So that means that Fleischer did...
Nine,
right. Thanks with the... Yeah, I hate math. Anyway, yes, so...
Well, it hates you.
Yeah, it definitely does. But anyway, yeah, so that's the deal. And I would be remiss in not mentioning Alan Duchovny, who I mention a lot in my book. He was part of the radio show. He was over The New Adventures of Superman. And he was the one who brought over the radio actors for the Filmation version. And he also hired Olan Saleh to play Batman and Casey Kasem to play Robin. And he was the one that whipped the DC staff into shape because they made him the executive producer of the series because, according to Lou Scheimer, he was the only one at DC Comics in 1966 that had media experience. And so he got the job.
And he worked on the radio show?
Yes.
Too?
Yes, he worked on the radio show also. And then later, he became a CBS executive, greenlighting a bunch of shows, and he worked with Filmation to create Isis because Filmation didn't want to pay for the licensing for Mary Marvel. So they like, we'll come up with our own superhero.
Interesting. So, yeah,
Alan Duchovny is one of those lost, forgotten DC guys that did a lot, contributed a lot, and made things happen. I just think it's really cool that he's associated with Superman for a long period of time. And then when the Filmation Superman shorts showed up in the, help me out, Dan, in Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah. When
I remember those.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, go check out the last couple episodes of this very show because we get into all of this. Mm-hmm. If you want episode zero and plus zero with the alternate cover.
Right.
Yeah, that was back. That was after the superheroes had been nixed from
Saturday morning
regular programming because of Action for Children's Television
and violence.
They then became, as you put it, and you put it so beautifully last episode, they became ambassador for our social values.
Yeah, right. Right.
What really represents the best of us. And they did that through Sesame Street.
Spider-Man did the same on the Electric Company.
Right.
And the Electric Company, damn, Spider-Man rocked the hell out of Electric Company.
The first first live-action Spider-Man.
First official live-action,
That's right. Thank you. That's the dude. Okay, Ned, you're at 40 points. Mark, you're at 10, Wheatley.
Narrated by Morgan Freeman, too, so yeah.
Oh, that's right, Ed. Morgan Freeman. Okay, that's 10 points, Wheatley. You're back on the board.
I loved that show.
That version of Superman was played by Lenny Weinrib, or I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last.
Lenny Weinrib, yeah.
Yeah, Lenny Weinrib. Thanks, Ned. Because I think Bud Collier, I think he had already passed, or maybe he wasn't well enough to do the voice anymore. So it was kind of cool, Superman on the electric, I mean, on Sesame Street, and there's like two or three Batman shorts on
gosh, I don't think I've ever seen those. Street.
If I mean, I didn't see them until I watched them on YouTube, because I think those. I was a little too old for Sesame Street. And also there was a Filmation Archie short featuring Jughead on Sesame Street at the same time that there were Archie cartoons running on CBS, which I'm like, wow, does CBS know about this?
That's crazy. Huh.
You know what gives me a rad feeling about that period in Sesame Street Electric Company is that ultimately our parents, grandparents, grown-ups, with their tax dollars, we're paying for that in part. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Public television.
Yeah.
Not the letter of the law, but the vibe of public domain when it comes to these today very high-priced IPs.
Yeah.
Right.
The fact that you would have Spider-Man and Superman show up on Sesame Street. And that speaks to the broader back in the day when Mego had the license for both DC and Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
How we forget how low stakes financially this stuff used to be.
Yeah.
Yet it's that same time period that we're always mining, harvesting to give a broader context to what we're dropping dollars for to this very day.
Yeah.
Everybody, you all own a little bit of Superman because he hung out with Big Bird. Think about that.
The next evolutionary leap in the Thunderverse has arrived. The Ring of Thunder is a whole week's wrestling in a half hour.
What?
The Ring of Thunder is a whole week's wrestling in a half hour.
What?
Every show.
What?
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 You come up around here wedding in sexy Thor's yard like he's anything but the hammer swinging, burrito eating, mic blazing, marking out but never tapping out Lord of Thunder, like you would do anything but sit down, open your ears, and take in the Ring of Thunder wherever you find your podcasts, like you would find any other podcast in the Thunderverse or the ESO Network.
Friends, this is Beth
and Kavika
from Thunder Talk. Would you like to hear more from Adult Swim's Ned Hastings?
I would. He's awesome.
Then be sure to listen to our latest episode. We're talking about some Marvel stuff, some TV stuff, and maybe a little chat about Christmas music.
With a splash of mature content.
Find Thunder Talk on your favorite podcatcher, and you can hear part two of the interview with Ned.
And a special Aqua Teen announcement.
Ooh, I miss Meatwad.
Ned Hastings, everybody. Ned Hastings, you are always welcome back on this show anytime.
Thanks for having me.
Oh my God, thanks for being here.
Let's talk about the Batman cartoons next time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Let's definitely talk about the... Oh, hey, part two, everybody. Ned Hastings, coming soon. We want to apologize for the low dollar value of the swag bag waiting for you in our green room. We'll work on that.
It's okay. You have a great bar.
I mean, it's cheap, but it's free. So, you know, who are you to complain?
It's a bunch of useless Dodgers World Series champions t-shirts that they never were able to use.
You know, okay, yeah, Wheatley beat me to it. I was going to say, Ned, you're welcome back anytime. Wheatley, I never want to see your face again because the Braves took the NLCS from my Dodgers.
Are you in Atlanta also?
No, I'm in the Greenville, upstate South Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're two hours from Atlanta.
Gotcha. But this is my grandfather was a Braves fan, so it kind of got passed on to me. It's the closest Major League ball team we got.
Smart man.
Yeah. No, I'm born and raised LA adjacent. We're carpetbaggers out here. We're of the West. We don't buy into this whole Yankee / Southern man kind of. We're better than all of you. But the Dodgers obviously weren't, so whatever. Ned.
Yes.
Do you have a social media presence? Is there anything you want people to type into their internet in order to connect with you, find you, be about you?
I'm on Facebook. That's kind of it. It's not anything exciting. I have an Instagram that I don't really keep up with much. But I will say, I don't know when this will drop, as the kids say. But we've got new episodes of Squidbillies airing now. This is the final season of that show.
Oh, wow.
I'm not sure what else is coming down the pike, but that's the big thing right now. That's what I was working on up until about a month ago.
Very cool. Very cool. Mr. J.T. Wheatley, History of Comic Books Podcast. Where can we find you? What are you about?
You can find me on practically all podcasting platforms, Apple, Spreaker, Stitcher, and so forth. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
Yeah, you can.
And I've got a lot more research after this episode because you got so many angles to go research now.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh, yeah. I'm never going to run out of content, I'll tell you right now.
There you go.
There you go. The Season 4 History Comic Book, sponsored by the Best Editors of Our Lives podcast. Speaking of which, Mark, generally on this show, we don't do this bit, this whole where can you find us and all of that, because it's just you and me.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, it's like, well, you already found us. Here you are listening to us.
Here we are. But what I will say is that today I posted my Best Saturdays of Our Lives t-shirts. I'm having a fire sale, you know.
Oh, cool.
My t-shirts are $12.95 with $2.50 shipping because they have to go. And we have all sizes. They come in blue and black. So I want people to know, go to my website and order yourself a shirt, along with a book.
Yeah,
I'm on my way.
Yeah, I've got one. You should get one.
Okay, I've already got two copies of the book, so I'm just going to get the t-shirt this time.
All right, cool.
Yeah, well, now there's a blue and a black.
Oh, there you go.
Okay. And you didn't even talk about the refrigerator magnets and the stickers. And
oh, right, all right. That. So with every signed copy, you get a sticker, a Best Saturdays of Our Lives sticker, and a magnet.
Yeah, you do.
Love it. Love it.
Boom.
Awesome.
We also have a little show we call Thunder Talk that you should check out. It's for adults. And, you know, you can hear Mark and I cuss. Thanks for tuning into the 8 o'clock show. Bounce over Thunder Talk for the 11 o'clock. It gets a little blue.
Up, up, and away.
Ned wins, everybody. Yep. Ned wins.
The Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast is a co-production of the Best Saturdays of Our Lives Studios and the Weirdos Workshop. To get a personalized signed copy of the Best Saturdays of Our Lives book, go to thebestsaturdaysofourlives.com. This is Mark McRae signing off.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.